Welcome to the Polite Politics Podcast.
Political issues are too important to be decided by grown adults behaving like five-year-olds on a playground.
Your once-a-week guide to the real issues facing America. We'll forget the bias and the yelling.
There are good, honest, intelligent people on both sides of most political issues.
And just tell you what's really happening in America.
Welcome into the Polite Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Page. I've got a great show lined up for you today. On the show, Representative Rob Bishop, congressman from the great state of Utah, is going to be our guest. He's going to break a little bit of news and talk a lot about life in Washington and what he's doing as head of the Natural Resource Committee. In addition, we're going to talk about free speech in light of those shootings down in Texas and how our media has gotten this completely wrong. You might even hear me raise my voice just a little bit. But starting off, this first segment is all presidential election coverage. At the center of our presidential election coverage nationally is, of course, Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee. Hillary this week made news by announcing that she would expand President Obama's executive amnesty program. Now, what was President Obama's amnesty? Congress is and has been at a stalemate on immigration for nearly a decade now. Republicans believe that our border needs to be enforced more strictly. Democrats believe that we need to find a peaceful solution so that people who are here and who have been here peacefully without breaking the law for decades can have the right to get on a path to citizenship, can pay a fine, something like that. There are some Republicans who cross one way, there are some Democrats who cross the other way, but those are generally the feelings here. President Bush, during his second term, tried to push legislation to do both of those things together. It failed, and at that time, Senator Obama fought against it. However, President Obama, since he's been president, has been in favor of immigration reform that looks pretty much exactly like President Bush's. Just after the 2014 election, he demanded Congress pass reform or he'd do something about it. He did. He gave an executive order. You may have heard about it. It showed up on Saturday Night Live and other places where he pretty much just said, prosecutors, we're not going to chase people who are here illegally that meet certain criteria. Essentially, they hadn't committed crimes. They'd been here for a certain amount of time. He even allowed them to sign up and get an ID card protecting them from prosecution. Now, this is currently held up in the courts. It's controversial as to whether or not it's legal. There is no question that the president has the authority to direct where we use our legal resources. So the reality is we don't have police officers, or at the federal level, FBI agents, ICE agents, and others, to be able to enforce every little law and get every little infraction. And that's generally a good thing. If you go a mile per hour over the speed limit, my guess is you probably don't want to get pulled over. And you don't expect to get pulled over for going a mile per hour over the speed limit. There's discretion there. The question is whether President Obama was creating a broad policy or whether he was just using his prosecutorial discretion. And the courts are debating this right now. It's on hold right now because of a lower court ruling, and it's being appealed up, but we'll see what happens. My guess, it ends at the Supreme Court. But regardless of what you think of this immigration policy, and regardless of what you think of what it does, Hillary has proposed that she would expand it as president to include more people. Speaking of the Clintons, let's talk a little bit about presidential coverage. You know, Hillary has only answered 7 media questions since she declared for public office. And the first sit-down interview, in-depth interview, given by a Clinton since she declared her run for office is from Bill, which is hilarious because her spokesman then comes out and says, well, this isn't about Bill, it's about Hillary. But Bill is the highest profile spokesperson they have, and they use him more than her. Take it for what it's worth, at least so far. So Bill was on a jaunt to Africa. We talked about last week the safari with some of the donors that came and was visiting with a reporter. And the reporter asked about the Clinton Foundation and about his speeches. He said he's not going to stop giving speeches because he, quote, needs to pay the bills. Now, that one was a really, really poor statement because, of course, he's made over $100 million in speeches. And so the notion that he needs to, quote-unquote, pay the bills didn't go over well. It's kind of like Hillary a few months back said they were, quote-unquote, dead broke when they left the White House. They did have some legal obligations due to Bill's conduct, and we'll get to that in a second. But regardless, for people who have hundreds of millions of dollars, more money than most Americans and their entire families will see in their lifetime, this one, that just really hurt and went really below the belt. Now look, Bill said something here, but before he said it, Mark Halperin, who wrote the definitive book on the 2008 election called Game Change, made the comment that the Clintons are held to a higher standard than others. And I just have to react to that. That is ridiculous. And it leads to our first edition of our segment, Whenever Somebody Tells a Major League Lie.
Your pants are on fire. Seriously.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Fire!
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Let's be clear here. In 1984, Gary Hart was on path to the Democratic nomination until it came out he was having an extramarital affair. All of a sudden, his campaign was over. In the 1990s, when Clarence Thomas was up to be Supreme Court Justice, in his hearings, Democrats brought in a woman who claimed he had sexually harassed her by making some dirty comments at her. A few years later, President Clinton is repeatedly accused of sexual harassment, he's actually accused of rape a couple times, open about the fact that he's had extramarital affairs, and it's well known and well documented, and he gets off scot-free. Lest you think that society just changed over the course of that, like, two-year period. Since then, John Edwards has been roasted for cheating on his wife. Bill Richardson, former governor of the state of New Mexico, who's always mentioned as a possible vice presidential candidate or somebody people consider, never gets picked. You know why? An article pointed it out by one of John Kerry's advisors. He's a womanizer. So let's be clear. Bill, from the start, has gotten a pass in a way that other people haven't. He's been held to a lower standard. But let's talk about the finances. The Clintons in the 1996 election broke a lot of campaign finance rules, even back before there were campaign finance reform acts. The media, not spending a whole lot of time pointing out Hillary's vociferous statements against gay marriage, her strong statements against illegal immigration, even though she's flipped. Bill, get this story. This one is the one that kills me. Jeffrey Epstein is a man who is a convicted sex offender, multiple underage women, and he owns a little island that he takes buddies off to, and they have orgies, which is legal. They can do what they want. But as part of that, you now have someone who says she was a sex slave who was involved in Bill Clinton was showing up at these parties with underage girls. Is the media covering it a ton? No. Is the Justice Department investigating? No. How about on the finance side, the complete finance side? Their Clinton Foundation, there's been reporting by the New York Times, there's been reporting by the Washington Post, there's been reporting by outlets that will endorse Hillary Clinton for president. And they're saying there are questions. President Obama's advisors are saying, look, these are legitimate questions. It's a story. Guess what? Justice Department investigating? No. No, they're not. Here's my point. The Clintons, the defense of the Clintons, the argument for the Clintons has always been that sure, they have a little bit of corruption, but I like their politics. And a lot of people who believe that. I'm not meaning to trash that opinion. That's an opinion that a lot of Americans have. That's why they have fond feelings about President Clinton. They like what happened in the 90s, and they're willing to overlook some of his personal failings. That's fine. But to claim that the Clintons are held to a higher standard is laughable. With the exception of John F. Kennedy, and the Kennedys in general, who have gotten away with murder, literally, the Clintons have gotten the freest pass of anyone in American politics since World War II. Not even close. And so to anyone who would say the Clintons get a pass, they get way too harsh a treatment from the media, I say this.
Your pants are on fire. Seriously.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Fire!
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We'll be back with some discussion of freedom of speech. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Be sure to like the Polite Politics community fan page on Facebook and be sure to tell your friends. Welcome back. You know, I like to criticize our media and say that it is the problem, but what has happened in the coverage of Texas's shooting this week has been some of the worst journalism I have ever seen. Let's go ahead and start by talking about what happened down in Texas a week ago. A group that is anti-Muslim, that is hateful toward Muslims, and that is provocative, held a Muhammad cartoon drawing party. Now, for those of you who don't know, the Islamic religion depicting Muhammad as a character either by drawing a picture or by having an actor play Muhammad is deeply, deeply offensive to Muslims. It's something that's kind of a red line that you don't cross. It's deeply offensive to them. That it was cartoons of Muhammad that led to that Charlie Hebdo shooting a couple months back in France. This group was doing it to be provocative. Two people from ISIS showed up, opened fire, and were killed by a security guard who was there on site. Jon Stewart this week did a segment called "No, It's Really Not Okay to Shoot People Just Because They Offend You." That was a good start, and he's actually the closest. But listen to this Washington Post headline. This is their actual headline. Event organizer offers no apology after a thwarted attack in Texas. The Washington Post headline is demanding the person who hosted the Muhammad cartoon drawing party, who admittedly is a bad person, should have to apologize. It's hinting that. Offers no apology. Can you imagine if the Washington Post ran an article called "Rape Victim Offers No Apology for Walking Down Dangerous Street Late at Night"? People would go nuts, and they should. No matter what crime is inflicted against you, you are not responsible for it. You just aren't. No rape victim is ever responsible for being raped. And these people, no matter how provocative they were being, no matter how offensive they were being, are not responsible for somebody coming and trying to shoot them. How hard is that to grasp? Hey, Washington Post.
You are the problem.
It's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America.
The destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office.
You're making our country a worse place. I would expect you not to have a perfect understanding of the First Amendment if you weren't a journalistic institution, somebody who screams First Amendment anytime anybody tries to criticize the ridiculous way you characterize a lot of the work that you do. So, in light of that, and I'm speaking directly to the Washington Post here, let's give a primer on free speech, the First Amendment and a modern liberal society. First, freedom of thought and conscience is at the heart of our national identity. The First Amendment pretty much guarantees you the right to think whatever you want and to say whatever you want, as long as you're not directly threatening someone else. This means, at its core, that we are protecting unpopular speech. Not popular speech, because people aren't going to try to stop popular speech, but they are going to try to stop unpopular speech. This means that our Constitution protects awful people who say offensive things. Flag burning is legal. The Supreme Court's landmark decision on this involves Skokie, Illinois. The Illinois Nazi Party wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois, even though it was a neighborhood that was predominantly Jewish and had Holocaust survivors in it. Think of it. Nazis wanted to march in Skokie, even though it was a town of Holocaust survivors. The Supreme Court said, look, we don't have to agree with this speech, but we'll defend it. The Westboro Baptists, who hold signs taunting homosexuals with anti-gay slurs, are allowed to do what they do. Is it wrong? Yes, it's morally wrong. They're still allowed to do it. So, two fallacies people have about our freedom of speech. The first is people trying to criminalize speech they don't like. We have a couple groups trying to do that right now. For example, in New Hampshire, there is a group trying to criminalize peaceful abortion, anti-abortion protesters, people who stand outside abortion clinics and peacefully protest. A group in New Hampshire is trying to get them blocked. The Supreme Court struck that down 9-0, yet the group in New Hampshire is still trying to do it to waste taxpayer funds. We should never criminalize speech just because we don't like it. If it's not directly threatening and directly harmful, and the standard for that is really high, pretty much saying, I'm going to kill you to someone's face could be considered violation of free speech. But other than that, pretty much allowed to do what you want. That's fallacy number one that we should criminalize. But the second is, we can also be honest about awful people. Let's talk about Charlie Hebdo and this group down in Texas. Both deliberately offend. Both are trying to be offensive. Do they have a right to be protected? Yes. Should the FBI offer them protection? Of course they should. To date, the FBI, as far as we know, still has not reached out to this group or tried to help them, which is offensive. All citizens are entitled to that protection. That said, there is also nothing wrong. There are groups on the right who are looking at these people saying, oh, they're saints, they're martyrs, they're so nice. They are martyrs for free speech. People who are killed for saying something are martyrs for free speech, but that doesn't mean they're good people. It is okay and even appropriate to stand up for the right to freedom of speech and even acknowledge those who die as martyrs without endorsing what they say. President Obama said this a little while back, and it got a lot of conservatives freaking out. Quote, the future does not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam. Conservatives freak out at this statement because they try to spin it as saying that nobody can criticize Muhammad. That's ridiculous. Conservatives, you're wrong. You're flat wrong here. People who trash other people's beliefs for no other reason other than to trash them, and people who spend their lives trying to tear down other people and trying to offend other people, end up in the ash bin of history. Look through history. Seriously. Take a look through at the people we look at as heroes and the people we look at as martyrs, and then notice what they don't have in common. For the most part, there are a handful of exceptions. I'm about to quote one of them. But it's the Isaac Newtons, it's the Martin Luthers of the world, it's the Galileos, people who had a principled objection on one subject and weren't just flagrantly offensive. There's a reason we look back at those people who had principled, thoughtful objections and were not flagrantly just attacking for the sake of attacking. People who intend to offend and spend their lives doing it, they have a right to do it, they should be protected in doing it. But, and this is the most important point, even though we believe in that free speech, there's nothing wrong with saying they're bad people for deliberately trying to offend others. I like what this misquote of Voltaire, who's one of the exceptions to the rule I just gave, this is a misquote of him, but it represents the intent of what he often believes. I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. That should be the principle that we fight for in this country, that people have the right to freedom of speech. They have the right to say what they want. They have the right to believe what they want. They don't have to agree with it. And there's nothing wrong with criticizing. Now, last point. We need to have a discussion about civil society. Because independent of the notion of freedom of speech as an element of the First Amendment, which is a matter of law, there's also a cultural question of when should we get up in arms because it's legal to boycott Donald Sterling. You may remember him. He was the owner of the Clippers, a basketball team, who said he didn't want black people at his games. Obviously deeply offensive, and the NBA forced him out. But this has gone to a really unhealthy extreme. It's certainly an appropriate reaction in serious cases. Imagine somebody who walks in to your business and wants a customer service job, public facing, and he has a swastika tattooed on his head. I actually met a gentleman who had this. I asked him about it. He said, it was the worst decision of my life. I can't get a job. Of course he can't get a job. He has a hateful symbol on his forehead screaming to everybody who comes into the store that they should feel uncomfortable. So of course he never gets a job. It could be taken as threatening toward Jewish individuals and minorities. But, as I said a second ago, this has been taken to an unhealthy extreme. For instance, we have a state university, the University of North Texas, students protesting, trying to prevent the governor of the state of Texas from speaking at their commencement. I'm sorry, he's the governor of your state. You're at a state institution. Come on. We also had the Mozilla CEO fired a few years back because he had donated to Prop 8, $1,000 to the Proposition 8 campaign years and years before that. The intellectual founder of the gay rights movement in America, Andrew Sullivan, wrote, "If this is what we've become, I want no part of it." After that, people get out of control. So where's the line? Where's the test? Here's the test I'd like to suggest. Little bit of history for you. You may have heard of McCarthyism. Senator Joseph McCarthy from Wisconsin was a senator for 10 years, from 1947 to 1957. He held hearings about trying to purge our government of communists. That led to blacklisting of any communists in Hollywood as well. People who were members of the Communist Party were unable to get jobs. People said, oh, we won't touch a communist, we won't work with them. And society looks at both of these actions and still considers them an abomination. Says it was morally wrong, and McCarthyism has become the name we give to people who go on these witch hunts trying to root out anyone who has an unpopular opinion. So here's my test, and I think in general, when we look at these things, you should ask, is it worse than communism? And no, I'm not talking about your 2015 communism that your professor says is theoretically peaceful. I'm talking about the communism of the 1950s. Let's be clear what communism has always stood for, but most certainly stood for in the 1950s. Number one, genocide. Conservative estimates put that during the 70 years that communism was really operative on the globe, from about 1920 to 1970, conservative estimates have those communist leaders killing at least 140 million people as part of just oppression, general oppression. 140 million people. That is 2.5 Holocausts per decade for those 70 years. Number two, there were no freedom of thought or individual rights in these countries. The government could say or do whatever it wanted and do whatever it wanted with you. This included killing and discriminating against homosexuals and other minorities. Finally, communism of that time had an aggressive belief that it should be spread throughout the world through violence. The thought of communism was that there should be violent revolutions in every country to inflict this upon people. So my test for whether you should boycott something, for whether society should tolerate mass boycotting and that, is simply this. Was it worse for a person to be a member of the Communist Party or to say or do whatever it is they said or did? I'll let you make your choice on each one of these, but I think that's a good moral standard we should all follow. When we come back, Representative Rob Bishop, congressman from the great state of Utah, is going to make a little bit of news and talk a little bit about what it's like in Washington. Hey everyone, thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air.
My guest today is a congressman representing the state of Utah, Congressman Rob Bishop. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it. I'm curious, Congressman, just as an introduction to you, you've been in Washington for a little while. You got elected in 2002, right, and took office in 2003, so you've been there a little over a decade. Why did you choose to do it?
That is an interesting story. Actually, the incumbent congressman retired. I hadn't thought about replacing him or running for Congress, but I realized there were people who would be supportive of me if I ran this time then, who may not be supportive if I tried for some other office like governor or not. And I always had an interest, concern about it, especially going back to the years I was in the legislature where I found out there was a kind of interface the state has with Congress. So there was an opportunity. My family was supportive. I really didn't think I'd win, to be honest with you, and we just made the try.
Well, thank you. Do you regret that decision? You feel okay about it still, looking back at that game?
You know, there are some days. Right now, I've been made the chairman of the Resource Committee, which to me is really important for the state of Utah. But it also gives me a chance to do some reforms that I've always wanted to do, and I want to fulfill that obligation. In the House, we are term limited as how long you can be as a chairman. I'd like to fulfill that, and then I'd like to move on to something else. I have to admit, there are times where I really would rather be a school teacher again.
Well, that, you know, that I appreciate that candor, and I appreciate your willingness to say that. Let's dive in a little bit to that resource committee. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do on that? In talking with Congressman, what we quickly learned is that most of your work actually is more on the committee side, or that seems to have where you have the most influence.
Especially in the House. Members of the Senate has more flexibility because they have rules, but none of them know what they are and they don't abide by them. On the House, there is a limitation of what you can do on the floor, very close time limits. So people's reputations are made in the committee. Most of the work they do happens in the committee. So the committees are extremely important on the House side. For the Resource Committee, it deals with everything that takes place on federal lands or offshore. So anything that deals with energy on federal lands, the federal lands itself, parks, BLM, fish and wildlife, Native American issues or indigenous native issues, and water development. Those are all part of the purview of my committee.
Wow, well, that's pretty broad and has to be expanding, I'd imagine, with fracking and with some of the other energy issues. And then I know Utah has a movement to try and get some local control of some of those lands. So I imagine that's pretty heavy emphasis.
Yeah, let me make sure your listeners realize there's also bifurcation. So there is an energy committee that deals with those issues on state and private property. The Resource Committee deals with those same issues, but only on federal property. So on a lot of things, what I have to do is try to coordinate with Energy and Commerce Committee or coordinate with the Judiciary Committee or coordinate with the Armed Services Committee, because we have them, and they're compartmentalized in some way as far as what jurisdiction each committee has.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. I'm curious, let's turn back a little bit to Washington. You've been there a little while through a Republican president, now coming to the end of a Democratic one. How's Washington changed in the last 12 years when you've been there, good and bad? What differences have you seen?
To be honest, I think Washington is very similar today as it was when I first came back here. I was somewhat naive and a little bit surprised about what I found in Washington. There are two sets of minds, and I think a lot of those work in the bureaucracy, so they stay, the presidents come and go, the bureaucrats stay. One mindset really wants to try and devolve responsibility and power from the federal level back to the states, where I think you have better management decisions being made, and people have some kind of access to those decision makers. There is another mindset that simply thinks that everything needs to be local and needs to be consolidated within Washington, that only Washington, and obviously because I'm negative here, I don't believe this mindset, but only Washington has the right ideas for the entire country, and only Washington is good enough to make those decisions. And any conflict between state governments or local governments in Washington, Washington has to win. I reject that, but that is a common mindset. And that those mindsets or those two approaches actually stay even as individual players, as the president or members of Congress come and go.
I wonder, that speaks to the heart of kind of the media narrative of Tea Party versus establishment. And I know the media hypes that, and it's kind of come up after you got there. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that? What is the real dichotomy between quote-unquote Tea Party versus establishment Republican? Is there a difference? Do people see that?
I don't, to be honest with you. I see it more as a statement of degree. I think if you actually were to talk to the so-called Tea Party people and the establishment people, you'll find like 85 or 95 establishment Republicans we're talking about here. I think they would agree on like 85 to 90% of the stuff. There may be a difference in tone. There may be a difference in emphasis. I think establishment types are more willing to take small steps to move in the right direction. Sometimes the Tea Party types want to do it all and want to do it now, and I can understand that mindset as well. So I think it's a matter of degree. I don't really think there's two different camps and dichotomies. And so I've been usually called a Tea Party type person, but I've sometimes been called an establishment person because I've been here for a while. And I feel comfortable actually in both modes.
I'm curious, you talk about kind of the two mindsets and how there's a lot of similarity. How do you decide if you're going to vote for legislation or not? I mean, some of it's really easy. It's this I believe in or this I don't. But when you get some of these, particularly spending bills, they're really long. There's some good. There's some bad. How do you make that decision?
It's very difficult. And I don't want to sound cheesy, but I do try and pray about it in making those decisions. So let me give you an example. I'm an old school teacher. No Child Left Behind was passed before I came to Washington. I thought it was a dumb idea when I was teaching, and I still think it's a dumb idea. There is an education reform bill going through the House as we speak that does a lot of good things to change, but it's nowhere near what I would like to see as a reform bill. So the question I have to ask myself is, are the reforms that are going in there good enough to vote for it, or do I hold out for something better, knowing that something better may never actually come along? And that has to be done on a case-by-case basis. There is no matrix that I can use to deal with that. Simply, a gut feeling of, are we at least moving in the right direction? It's like Senator Graham once told me, and I think he said this before, that if he's trying to go from Washington back home to Texas and he gets as far as Memphis, that's not bad. It's only if he starts from Washington and ends up in Boston, then he's got a problem.
That's a really good illustration. I think that explains it well. I'm curious, let's fast forward to whenever your career ends, and I think it's a credit to you that you're kind of open about this is what I want to do, and then I'm going to go do something else. I'm going to make you emperor for a day, and you can do anything you want. What is the one accomplishment? And I'll even let you change our immigration law. What is the one thing that you want to accomplish that you can look back and say, this would be my dream accomplishment while I'm in Washington?
We have done a few things already that are small, in which people told me I could never get it done, and I got it done. So let me give a shorter and a broader answer, and I'll take up too much time. I apologize in advance.
That's fine. That's fine.
So when I first got to Washington, I found out the federal government was redoing a military-based runway at Dugway in Utah. But in all the brilliance, we were doing it, and from the time the appropriations went to the actual construction, inflation hit, they ran out of money, so they were going to rebuild the runway 2,000 feet too short for the landing of an F-16. And emergency landings out there on the Utah Test and Training Range, they needed that. No one, they all told me, you know, it's too far along the process, you can't get it done. I went back there, I worked with the state of Utah in a way that had never been done before. We tried to break traditions. The end result is I got the thing built and the extra 2,000 feet put in the runway, and it has saved lives. So every once in a while you got small things like that for which I will always be proud and happy. My overarching goal, though, has always been I want to reinstate the concepts of federalism so that state and local governments have more control in their decisions and take them out of here. And basically, if a person wants to have input into their system, if they want to have control of their lives, if the decisions are made in Washington, you don't have control over that. I mean, what can you do? Go back and stand in front of one of the massive apartment buildings in Washington and throw rocks at their windows? If decisions are made at the county level and the state level and the city level, then people actually have a chance of having their voices heard and have some kind of say in what goes on in their future. That has always been my goal, and I'm going to keep fighting for that goal. And that is it's tough to try and get that done.
Wonderful. Thank you. I love that question because I feel like most people are animated by one or two things, really. There are a lot of things that we like to accomplish, but you have 435 minds in Congress. All probably have one or two or three things that is really a focus. And so I want to help our audience see what it is that you really want to, what you really want to push for. My last question, Congressman, and I really appreciate your time, is there a misconception that the public doesn't see? Is there something, if you could tell the public, here's the one thing that you don't get or that the media doesn't tell you about what's going on here? If I could give you one of those, what would that be?
I'm not sure. You mean about Washington or about members of Congress?
About Washington or members of Congress, maybe a misconception that the public tends to have because of our media setup.
And I don't know if I necessarily blame this on the media per se, or it's just an easy way of doing it, because you always make jokes about members of Congress and state legislators, and I've been both. In fact, I make jokes about it. We all make jokes about them ourselves. From my experience, I've had two overriding concepts that have seared within me. And it kind of goes back to being a government teacher for so long in high school as well. You don't need to be an expert to be able to make decisions on self-government. You don't have to have a class or degree. Anybody with the right amount of data and the proper mindset can govern themselves and make proper decisions. And especially when I was in the legislature, it would be so cool for me to see like a car salesman or a motorhome dealer being able to talk about some of the details of a very complicated school finance formula. People can govern themselves. Second thing I've learned is that most people, even the Democrats who vote terribly wrong, most people in Washington and the state legislative level are really sincere. They're not out there. They're not on the take. They can't be bought. they would give the shirt off their back for the good of the country or the state, which is something you might want to poke your mind's eye out thinking about, but it is still there. Every once in a while, there will be a bad apple, as happens in every organization, but they are so few in comparison to the others who really are doing this for altruistic goals. That makes me proud of being part of Congress and part of the state legislature and part of a concept of self-government, because I really do think most people are actually very sincere and they are very honest and they're very true people, even when they vote wrong.
Wonderful. Congressman, thank you so much for taking the time. I sure appreciate it.
I'm pleased to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air.